Okay, we had a little bit of a technological glitch, but we're back. And before we broke up, Vivian had been answering the question about what it was like for her to learn as a young person.
So I guess my experience in school was very much informed by my relationship with with language, and I went to a very like liberal progressive school that really valued you broke up. Wait. Sorry. That really valued diversity and inclusion, and social emotional learning in a way that now is very trendy and is sort of proven to help in any kind of school. We're moving away from what Paulo Freire would call the banking model of schools and towards something different, maybe more like a garden or something. A lot more buzzwords are getting thrown around that were being really utilized in my educational experience as a kid. So, I think at the beginning, like I said, reading and writing were really hard because of my bilingual status, which is proven to be true. Kids learn slower when they're learning a lot of different languages all at the same time, but in the end, their brains are a lot more flexible and elastic, and it's a good thing, but it was definitely challenging for me. And I think it also made me question the status quo always of what schooling was like. Who was in authority? Whom was telling whom what to do? And I think I've always really, really loved school and valued education super deeply, but I've also always been very critical of it, and questioned my authority figures a lot, which definitely bit me in the butt in high school and college at times, but and also made me think I would maybe never become a teacher because the academy, as sort of this established force of oppression, was not interesting to me. I did not want to be part of it. But here I am. And yeah, I think I still really question the tenet of oppression that is the educational world. And try to do best by my students.
So then, what did make you become a teacher?
I guess it was sort of a convenient situation for me. I'd always taken care of kids. I'd always worked at summer camps. I'd always been really interested in thinking about how kids grow and how they think. Children's art has always been super fascinating to me. And their imaginations are like the most cool and creative force. It was an easy job for me to have growing up working with kids. And basically, it was the work environment that felt most comfortable to me because people were nice. There was no competition. Everyone shares. Everyone steals from each other because it's all about making it the best thing possible for the students. And it was endlessly interesting to me because education is constantly evolving. Whereas, like, working in the food industry, which was my other, career path. It's like the interestingness of like cheese and olive oil is finite, at least I don't know, in my mind, there was a just sort of a dead end in terms of how engaging cooking could be. But every student in every year and every class is just an endless pool of intricacies, and there's a constant re-examination of what best practices are in education, and school is just super meaningful for everyone, you know, for families and the students and communities, and yeah, felt a lot more meaningful to me to pursue that. Yeah, and my other like passion was art and film and video and like entertainment. But that also felt like a very corporate and sort of like essentially capitalist world that I also felt like was a little bit poisonous. And when I was graduating university, where I studied media and educational media specifically, it felt like the only options were to live in New York or LA, and I didn't want to do that. So, yeah.
So tell me about the school that you work in now.
So the school I work in now is a school that you went to as a child. And so maybe you can tell me more about it than I can. From my perspective, it's a school that merged two very different schools into one. The Sierra School, which was a very sort of hippie liberal, no grades, more informal, more child-centered teaching environment. And the Prospect School, which was a much more like college preppy kind of academically rigorous, academically focused school, both in the Bay Area. And, you know, at a time when maybe both of those schools were struggling on their own, they combined, joined forces and shared their values. And I think it's made it for a really strong philosophy of education. I think that having taught there when Trump was elected, I saw the school sort of show up in a way that a lot of other schools weren't, and stand by their values in a way that a lot of other schools weren't, in terms of supporting and standing by their morals versus supporting the rich families and their politics. So Prospect Sierra is, you know, upper middle class independent school, and it can do a lot of things because it has a lot of those resources associated with that. But I think it does so in a way that's a bit more gentle and considerate. And yeah, I think it's a school that has like really, really good intentions and maybe doesn't always support everyone. And one of my criticisms of it is how a lot of the kids who live in the neighborhoods and the surrounding areas are not able to go to the school. It's a primarily like immigrant community, and it's a primarily white school. So, you know, it has some demographical sort of inconsistencies with its mission statement, but overall, what stands out to me about Prospect Sierra is how strongly it supports its teachers and how much it stands behind its teachers versus its donors. And that has been why I've continued to teach there.
You said that when things get hard, the school is good at standing behind its morals and its values. What has that looked like when you've seen it happen?
Well, like I said, you know, a lot of other schools in the area that have similar demographics, that have rich families kind of running the show sometimes, those are the families that get priority in that and that receive. The resources, and I think that Presbyteria is more intent on making themselves very clear as what their message is and standing by that and having the families that support those ideals and those morals and that mission statement as well be the ones that stick around instead of having to bend their practices around who shows up to admissions day. And I think that there are schools that really takes to heart the idea of growth mindset. You know, I've never been in a work environment where more of my bosses admit to their mistakes, which is pretty cool.
What is the growth mindset? I'm not familiar with that.
Growth mindset. It's something we can all use more of. It's a very difficult thing to sort of identify, but I guess it's very related to the idea of grit, which is one of these characteristics of successful students, regardless of, you know, socioeconomic background or even like learning disabilities and that kind of thing. Like if you've got grit, you will be successful. And when we think about, you know, all of these exceptional characters in the world that are celebrities and stuff, like, oh, I have ADHD, or I grew up poor, I have all these difficulties in my life, but I'm super famous now, or I'm super successful now. We can say a lot of times that those people got there because they had grit, or they had a growth mindset, which essentially is... Annie?
I'm here.
Okay. You're frozen. Which essentially is just like when you tell a kindergartner about growth mindset, you tell them that your brain is a muscle that actually grows when more connections are made inside of your brain. It's almost like it's building like a bird's nest or something. And the more little pieces that come together, the stronger it gets. So when you are learning something new and it's hard for you and you make a lot of mistakes and you have to try again and again and again, those little connections are being made. When you're just doing things that are easy for you all the time, those connections are already made. And yeah, they're going back and forth and it's very comfortable, but you're not actually growing your brain. So the idea of growth mindset is that you have to have that idea always in the back of your head that the hard things and the mistakes are what actually allow for growth. So when a kid is like, I'm never going to be able to do this, you know, you have to just say like, oh, like try having a growth mindset about it, which is just not helpful a lot of times because it's a really hard thing to wrap your head around, and not knowing how to do something doesn't feel good, but it's true. So, and it's helpful when you do persevere or when you do have grit, essentially, in those situations. Mm-hmm. So in schools, people really try to teach about the biology of it and what's really going on in our big brain muscles, because the more kids know about it, the more they believe it.
Okay, I want to pivot a little bit, and I wonder if you can tell me how you first became aware of COVID-19.
Yeah, I can think of two environments. One was at school because it was my work environment at the time. I was a long-term sub this spring for the elementary school Spanish teacher. So teaching K through fourth grade Spanish. And I was supposed to be there for a month, obviously in school, and the news was telling us about COVID-19 in China, coronavirus. And I remember going to a dance class with you, and, you know, it's a big ballroom full of people. And I was like, this isn't coming to the United States. It's not a big deal. It's like the flu. It's no biggie. I'll see you next week at dance class. And, you know, then these rumors started going around at school, like, we don't know what's going to happen. We have to prepare for things to go online, for kids to stay home for a few weeks. So I started preparing materials and thinking about what emails I could send out to each grade level. And then that became more and more sort of a less of a rumor and more of a truth. I was pretty prepared and, you know, I had my little documents set up for each grade level. And then I was in the staff lounge and somebody said, you know, shelter in place starts tonight. And I was like, what the fuck does that mean? Sorry if I can't curse on this. I was like, what is shelter in place? Like what emergency is this? You know, like how did this become sort of like this rumor of something happening in China? And now I can't leave my house, you know? Like kids aren't supposed to see each other anymore. Kids can't come to school to pick up their books. Like kids can't do anything. And we had one more day of school, I think, after that, or after like the warning about it. And there was probably like 12 kids that came for the whole elementary school. Well, mostly kids of color, mostly children of teachers. And I remember all of them playing on the playground together. And me being on lunch duty or whatever with another teacher, and we're kind of looking at each other like, is this okay? And she was like, just let them play. Like, and I was like, yeah, just got to let them play for the last time. And then we figured it out of how to get everybody the things they needed. And for the most part, you know, I think the school sort of built the ship while riding it for the rest of the school year as the shelter in place was extended and extended. But yeah. Was definitely a surprise.
Do you remember how your school first addressed coronavirus with the students?
That's an interesting question. I think it was just sort of something on the news. So we assumed that parents were talking about it at home. And, you know, we were all very aware that shelter in place meant no more school, you know. So I think that at first it was just... There's a bug that we have to wash our hands to get rid of, you know? And, you know, we got to wear masks or we can't be close to each other or, you know, we're going to make the bug grow, basically. But I wasn't really in direct contact with most of the families, so it was hard to know how they were digesting it. And I think one of the hardest things was not having their responses. You know, we were sending out work to them, but weren't really hearing back from the students, weren't really seeing any student work. And I think the school was really focused on just sort of having kids' emotional needs met and not really focusing on trying to like have them meet their next spelling test goals. You know, it was a lot more about just like make sure that them and their families were feeling okay. So, yeah, but at the same time, as a teacher and trying to like evaluate them in those moments, it was like, I don't have any information, even about their emotional well-being, you know.
What did you need to figure out during that time of transition?
What did I need to figure out? I needed to figure out how to streamline online resources. luckily the Spanish program had a lot online already, so it was just a matter of making sure that everyone had access and everyone knew how to have access. And then I think for my personal efforts, I needed to figure out how to get kids off of the screen. Like, that was my initial thought, was like, everything is going to be on the computer now. I just want to send them an instruction of something to do that's not on the computer, or that's not hard for them. Like, just send a video that they can sing along with. So I made a lot of videos of myself singing and doing silly dances and games. And especially for the little ones, they don't know how to type or read or anything. So it was just a matter of figuring out how to make learning accessible to them in a way that was going to be sustainable.
Who did you look to for leadership during that time?
I looked to the other teachers at each grade level. There was a constant sort of stream of information on Slack, because each grade level has its own little, you know, channel. So every group of teachers in each grade created sort of a centralized document that we were supposed to upload to, and then every grade had its own like structure of how they did it. So I would have to figure out that formatting, you know, for each group. And then, yeah, but I think also the administration and the school itself was very, very, was very intent on doing something as a school all together, and making sure that teachers felt really supported by the tech team. And it's interesting because, like, I remember having so many emails from the admin, from the head of school, from the tech team, like, this is what we're all doing, you know, and this is what we're sending to the families, and, you know, like, all of these resources, like, almost too much, and thank you all so much, and this is all the information we have, versus, like, friends I have at smaller schools or other schools, like, they would get an email at the end of the week from the head of school just like, doing great, guys, keep it up, you know, like, like, it was very much more everyone to themselves, like, figure out something, you know, and something is better than nothing. But from the beginning, it felt like my school was very, yeah, intent on making sure that everyone was as supported as possible. And I feel that way now with the beginning of the school starting too. It's like almost too much.
I'm curious about the school year this year and what the plans are. Do you think you can narrate in sort of basic terms what the general plan is for this coming year?
Yeah. There's been like a huge effort over the summer, a big planning team, trying to formulate sort of a couple different avenues for how to approach this year. One of them being in school, like a campus experience, which is very modified from the normal experience, having staggered drop-off times, having staggered, you know, break times, having pods of 12 students that don't interact with pretty much anyone else, limiting the amount of teachers that kids see. So having like rotating schedules for specialists. So like an art teacher would see kids maybe every day for 2 weeks or a month, and then not at all for a month. And then somebody else would come for contact tracing ease, obviously masks and lots of hand washing and social distancing, reformatting classrooms, shifting spaces to outdoors. There's a whole rigmarole about trying to get kids back to campus. And then there's this other side, which is all online, and how to best support distance learning. And then there's the hybrid sort of middle way, which I think is maybe more likely to happen than the on-campus, which is having half of the students be online and half of the students be in school and then switching. So having there be that same sort of block scheduling, but having there be half the amount of students on campus. So in terms of scheduling, it's been a nightmare for the people who've had to work on that this summer, but they've done it and they are, you know, saints in my eyes. And the tech team has worked really hard. So, you know, for the past couple of weeks, it's been just meetings of different teams, different grade level teams, everyone trying to get everyone else up to speed about how we're going to approach all the technology. And there's just these like rainstorms of resources coming from all sides, like, and platforms like, you know, Zoom and Slack and email and PowerSchool and Parent Square. And, you know, once you get into like all of the different little technology pieces of like, oh, there's this cool website you can use for videos, and there's this one you can make your own games and for animation, and your Bitmoji site and your site and your classroom and your da-da-da. Like, it is insane. And I am just starting to get all of my content of what I need to teach my kids, much less like, you know, who they are. I'm starting to get that information. And so I'm pretty overwhelmed in terms of how to implement it, or like which resources to choose from. But, you know, I think everyone is just taking it one day at a time. And I think a lot of people have been spending a lot of their summers working on this, and they want to just share what they've learned, you know? So, yeah. Yeah. But there's so many people who are like way more tech, like interested in tech, and like want to spend all of their time doing that. And I just know there's a lot of us and teachers I've worked with at the elementary school who are probably just like pulling out their hair, you know? I mean, you know who I'm talking about. Your third grade teacher, like, would have me write her emails sometimes because she didn't like that, you know? Like, I'm sure she's just hating this, hating it, you know? So, yeah.
Have you been able to hear from other teachers about how this is for them personally? And have you been able to share how it is for you?
Have I been able to hear from other teachers? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, a lot of my closest friends are teachers at other schools. So I hear from them and we share, you know, updates all the time. But I have not really been able to hear in an informal way from other teachers at my own school, because our meetings are so dense with like check-ins and onboards and, you know, pass-ups and, you know, all of these like just information like tsunamis that, yeah, I've been really itching to check in with the people I'm really good friends with, just in a general sense of like, what are you doing? You know, like, how are you doing? But yeah, I have friends who work in like elementary school and high school, charter schools, public schools. Yeah, it's all different.
to just do a quick time check because we are about 15 minutes before the end of the time we had agreed on for the interview today. But I do want to ask, it sounds like your school hasn't decided quite yet what its plan is going to be. Is that right?
The plan is distance learning for now. The plan, I think, is to be flexible and to have it be distance learning for now. Contra Costa County, where the school is, has been on the watch list because of the number of COVID cases. Can you hear me?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And recently is making its way off of the watch list. So they're allowing for students or for schools to release these applications that students and families can provide the school that would allow for us to open in-person school. So I think the idea is be online as long as that is the sort of publicly and universally accepted idea of safety. But as soon as there are other avenues for safety, I think they'll try to do that. Mm-hmm. But yeah, there's no plan that is enforced for the rest of the school year. I think a lot of schools are in that boat of like, we'll do this for now, and then if things get better, we'll do something else, you know.
What does that plan mean for you personally?
I feel really grateful to have a job that I love and that I care about and that is meaningful to me. That being said, part of me just wants like an answer about how to prepare for teaching. Like, are we going to be online or are we going to be in school? And doesn't even matter, because if we're in school and there's kids who don't show up or who want to be online, then are we all going to have to be on Zoom anyways so that it's equitable? I think that's a big question I have, is like, if I'm going to be in school, is it just sort of going to be me Zooming, but also with the responsibility of having a bunch of other teenagers, like preteens, in the room with me who I need to be the parent for, you know, and just sort of make sure that they're social distancing? Like, I'm not sure that's better. I don't know. And obviously I want what's best for the families, and I think they need childcare, you know, they need their kids out of their house, most of those families. But I just, it's hard for me to picture that being safe, and it's hard for me to picture that being like a lasting solution. I just see families getting COVID and the school shutting down again and it being kind of a sort of a disastrous on and off thing. But I'm going with the flow.
What is your level of concern for your students right now?
I had a pass-up meeting today, which is where their advisors from last year kind of give us their social, emotional, and like academic reports. It was exclusively for students of high need. So students who had a lot of social emotional challenges or academic challenges, who see counselors or, you know, tutors, learning specialists. So, I mean, that was kind of a big slap in the face to see how many kids really went into deep decline during distance learning in the spring, you know. Kids who have challenges but are super social, or kids who have really high self-esteem but struggle academically or something like that. Like, a lot of those kids, as reported by their teachers, became severely depressed and very visibly depressed. Like, I heard about a student who would attend her Zoom classes from inside of a dark cardboard box. And they had to kind of like lure her and eventually force her to attend classes outside of the cardboard box. And families that just weren't able to support their students' declining mental and emotional health. So my job contains also the responsibility of being an advisor for 12 students. And I just anticipate that being the harder part of trying to hold hands with these kids from far away. And a lot of them I've never met before. I just think trust and relationships are the biggest part of that. And I think it's really hard to form that when they feel super alone.
What's your level of concern for yourself?
I'm concerned that I'll be consumed by this, by this sort of constant effort to improve what is kind of just inherently a broken thing. I'm concerned that I will take very personally the issues of, you know, each individual child and their family situations. I'm also concerned that it'll be much easier for me to sort of detach if we are in distance learning for a long time. Like, concerned that I won't care as much as I would if I was in person with these students, if they're doing poorly or if they're not engaged or if they don't show up. You know, that would be a lot harder if it was in person, but on Zoom, it's like, well, you didn't show up, you know, that's kind of it. And I think it will affect me and obviously have a lot of empathy for these students and this community. But yeah, I think I just worry that it will also make me a worse teacher. And that I'll go crazy from so much Zooming and won't have time for myself, you know? But yeah, I'm optimistic about the community of the other teachers. There's definitely a big effort to support each other. So I'm optimistic.
We have about 5 minutes left, but I'm really curious, how are teachers showing their support to each other right now in your community?
Well, our school is doing something really unique that I would love for other schools to do, which is we have counselors for the teachers that are specific to affinity groups. So there's a counselor specific to Black teachers and staff members, one for all teachers and staff members that identify as a person of color, and all teachers and staff members that identify as white. So these three, you know, mental health professionals who work for the Wright Institute, and some of them have worked within our school community in the past in different ways, doing trainings for families and teachers. One is a parent of a student, so they're pretty involved already, but on a bi-monthly basis, so every 2 months, there's a scheduled meeting within those affinity groups, on Zoom to do like essentially a mental health check-in, just about how we're feeling. And a lot of that is kind of embedded into the ways that we run a lot of our staff meetings. There's a lot of work around identity. There's a lot of work around social justice and how we show up. But I think the intent of that is to make it so that no one is the facilitator, that everyone can kind of just be a participant and show up in a way where they're not holding anyone else. They're just being held, or, you know, being in community. So, yeah, I feel really grateful that that space is being built this year. But my big question about that was like, are other schools doing this? You know, are the schools where like this is that much more painful and difficult and challenging, are they getting this kind of support? And I think the answer is generally no, unless one of those healthcare professionals is volunteering their time. So yeah, but yeah, I feel like the school itself that I'm in, yeah, like I said before, like I think the communication aspect between teachers is like almost too much. people are very intent about checking in and having a lot of communication on about everything. Yeah, I mean, mostly about work, but people are curious to see how you're doing, which is nice. Yeah.
I've noticed that when you talk about your school, you often talk about it in comparison to other schools.
Yeah.
And I'm curious how you're feeling about the gap that you've described between your school and other schools, and what that means to you right now.
It's really frustrating. I feel a lot of, I feel, so in May or April, when I was applying for jobs, I was applying for jobs in New York at the Brooklyn Museum in Education, at an independent school in Manhattan, and at a few public schools in Oakland and Berkeley. And my intention when I became a teacher was not to embed myself into independent schools or private education. I believe in public education, and I believe that that investing in those communities strengthens neighborhoods and cities. And I definitely feel some remorse around not being part of that, especially right now. In my application process there, like, it sort of dead-ended. I never, you know, I followed up a few times, didn't hear back. COVID hit. I know they were going through all kinds of craziness, all kinds of hardship and complications. And Prospect Sierra reached out to me and offered me this job. And, you know, I think that there's privilege in that. But yeah, I mean, I think about the interlocking systems of oppression that exist in this school all the time. And when I was teaching there before in the elementary school, I saw it in the kindergarten. And right now, all of those, like you said, like gaps of access and resources are just widening and widening. And I think my way of coping with that is knowing that the students that I have also have needs, and that, you know, they were born into the world they were born into. And my job right now is to attend to their needs. No one has it easy right now. It's obviously all relative, but kind of like we were saying the other day, Annie, like, you know, I can't change Oakland, you know. I have to just sort of play my part and do my best in the little community I'm part of. And yeah, I guess just figure out other ways of reaching out and supporting other schools. I mean, yeah, but it's always on my mind.
Okay. We're just about at 7 o'clock, and I want to respect the time we agreed to. So I'm going to stop the recording now,
okay.
But I'll still be here. So
okay.
I'll see you in a second.
Okay.